Good morning. I'm going to ask Mr. Pranas to call our next case for consideration.
This is case number 820-1389, State of Minnesota versus Mitchell Curtis Madsen.
This is our second oral presentation today. We're running a little bit behind because of audio and visual issues in the first case hearing. If there's any problem that you have at all during this Zoom Gov platform, just either wiggle your hand, make some gesture, or just speak up. Please mute yourself when you're not speaking. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your case presentation. An additional 5 minutes will be reserved to you, Mr. Kelly, for rebuttal if you choose to utilize that. Please state your name and introduce which party you're speaking on behalf of in advance of your argument. And Mr. Kelly, with that said, you have the floor.
Good morning. May it please the court and counsel, may it please all of us that we soon transition back to in-person oral arguments. Appellant Mitchell Madsen asked this court to reverse his conviction following a guilty plea. At the 11th hour, Madsen was advised by prior attorney to admit to having reason to know that one of the 55 used cards in his name, in his possession, was stolen from its rightful owner, ostensibly by the person who then traded that vehicle in for a clean car and small amount of cash at Madsen's place of business. He's in the business of buying, trading, fixing, and reselling cards. Now, the standard of review from the Raleigh case, whether the district court abused its discretion in denying appellant's motion to withdraw his guilty plea prior to sentencing. The district court determined that Madsen had not established that it was fair and just to permit him to withdraw the guilty plea. Minnesota Rule of Criminal Procedure 1505 Subdivision 2 is not a complicated rule. These are not complicated facts. Under the Townsend case, the defendant has the burden of advancing reasons to support the withdrawal of his guilty plea. The state has the burden to show that prejudice would be caused by the withdrawal. Minnesota Rule of Criminal Procedure 1505 Subdivision 2 is, of course, less demanding than 1505 Subdivision 1, which is, after sentencing, a showing of manifest injustice by the movant.
Obviously, you have a strong burden because you're bearing the burden of showing that counsel was ineffective and that there's an objective standard of reasonableness that was not met. If we determine that this is reasonable under the circumstances, do you acknowledge then that you would lose on that prong? We don't even go on to the second prong under Strickland?
Yes. However, the ineffective assistance of counsel is actually enough if shown to ring the bell on the manifest injustice test, the higher tests found in Subdivision 1.
What is your strongest argument, your strongest facts that you say support that determination by this court?
So, to kind of reframe our burden, if you will, under Townsend, this court stated that my client's not permitted to withdraw a guilty plea for simply any reason. So, once again, look, but I believe that we have established ineffective assistance to counsel. My strongest argument, and before if the court please, I will remind the court that the state concedes at the time of the motion and today before this court that they can show no prejudice. But we're simply focusing in on that first prong. And the second prong is already waived by the state, if you will. Now, with regard to the facts of this case supporting 1505 Subdivision 2 burden, the trial counsel failed to file a witness or an exhibit list. One of the unique facts of this particular case is that the guilty plea involved having reason to know. And that does not apply to most intent crimes. And although sufficiency of the plea is not a question before this court, I would submit it has a place in the fair and just standard found in Rule 1505, Subdivision 2.
Mr. Kelly, can I just confirm, you made reference to the failure to file witness exhibit list. And my understanding, Judge Hannon made the point in her oral discussion or ruling that she seldom sees an exhibit witness list from defense attorneys, and notwithstanding their absence, would not disallow such evidence. I guess I'm assuming that alone, your client's not arguing, would show would fail the first Strickland standard in terms of the requirement of an attorney.
That's correct.
So
I want to tell you that on
Mr. Kelly, going back to Judge Sleater's question, then really the critical issue before us has to do with whether there was a failure to investigate that fell below the objective standard of reasonableness, and whether the failure to introduce certain documents fell below the objective standard of reasonableness. That, as I understand your argument, those are your two key points. Or your two key points relate to those issues. Is that correct?
I apologize for interrupting. We are saying that ineffective assistance of trial counsel under case law is enough for the manifest injustice standard. We don't have to show ineffective assistance of counsel to prevail under the fair.
You can't just allege it. You have to demonstrate why your counsel was ineffective at the stage that you're alluding to. And I know that one of the issues that you argue in your brief is that there was witnesses that had not been interviewed or things that had not been looked up. But at this point, don't you need to show us a favorable witness that should have, would have, could have testified in your client's behavior, something that would dispel that this was not a conscious or a deliberate choice by your client, as well as his prior counsel, in not investigating, not going down those avenues?
So we did, in the record that this court can rely upon, is the testimony at the motion to withdraw. My client testified and established that not only did he have a license, not only was he licensed to buy and sell cars, but that he had in his possession 55 different cars at the time of the offense. So the state's
theory. How does that relate, though, to the decision whether to investigate or not? How does that show that it was a matter of not a matter of trial strategy, but a matter of neglect?
My client testified, and my supporting affidavit in favor of the motion to withdraw outlined his defense with regard to have reason to know.
But you didn't present any documents to support that. I mean, you in your brief on page 8, you state that the information appellant had provided to counsel. I'm sorry, let me go down a bit. So it says, you refer to business records that you claim established that appellant had acquired the vehicle on a trade approximately 2 weeks prior to the offense date. And it's my understanding that you're alleging that those documents would have provided a defense for your client. But there isn't that, at least based on my review of the record, I don't see those documents in the record. There's no reference to the specific documents, what they are in the affidavit. So there really isn't anything in the record to support the assertions behind the defense that you claim would have been made. That's where I struggle here. Please correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think those documents are in the record.
I believe that's true, but we had never had a trial to submit them. We would have submitted
them. You have submitted them with the affidavit along with the petition that you filed?
Once again, I mean, I'm an officer of the court. We have the printout from the DMV that shows the list of vehicles that are in my client's possession for resale. We have the sworn testimony, uncontradicted sworn testimony of the appellant that he had the vehicles held for resale and that those documents had been provided to prior counsel. There's nothing in the record to indicate some reason why no witness list and no exhibit list would have been filed by the defense. In the brief that we did, appellant's brief.
Would you agree that the decision whether or not to present certain documents as exhibits is generally a matter of trial strategy?
There's no possible trial strategy to not show that the defendant was in possession of 55 vehicles and on the day in question chose to drive the one vehicle that he had in his possession that he knew or had reason to know was stolen. Why would anybody do that? There's no possible trial strategy for not submitting witness and exhibit lists. There's no possible trial strategy for not preparing a defense when your client has provided you with this information. In the procedural history of this.
Is there any information in the record as to what the witnesses would have testified to? I don't recall seeing that.
My client testified at the motion to withdraw the plea. That is document index number 54.
Right. Can you refer me to what page you're talking about in the transcript? Because I've read the entire transcript.
But my client was sworn, and he states on page 7, when questioned, how many vehicles did you possess in your name or hold titles for resale at that time? I would say approximately 55.
But what I asked you was, is there any evidence in the record as to what the potential witnesses that you're asserting should have been listed on a witness list would have testified to? I don't see.
That's on page 7, once again. The next question, verification was on one list generated by the Department of Motor Vehicles, and that's the list of vehicles that you are holding for resale, correct? That's correct. And those were provided to your lawyer. Yes, I did. So it would have been people from the DMV or a stipulation regarding the admissibility of those documents. And my client shows up on the day of trial and testifies that he then finds out that there's no witness list, no exhibit list, a last minute offer of no jail. He takes that, walks out to his car. He testifies 15 minutes after he did the deal, starts crying, called his wife and arranged for new counsel as soon as he could. So, you know, if this record, I would submit to this court, if this record doesn't ring the lower bell of subdivision 2 under 1505, I don't know what defendant would. He's clearly got a defense to a crime which has a unique mens rea element, and he doesn't have a defense attorney who presents that. The only thing that the respondent and the court was able to really refute what my argument was to cite his plea, and which is on the record under oath, and he signed a plea petition. But if that ended this analysis under 1505 sub 2, we'd have no reason for the rule. We'd have no reason for the distinction between 1505 sub 1 and sub 2. That there is a mechanism whereby aggrieved defendants can make a motion and withdraw a prior guilty. And that mechanism was put back before the district court. And the district court simply said, because she routinely has trials come up with no witness and exhibit list. I mean, I cut my teeth 30 years ago in front of judges in Anoka County, like Royth and Sokolowski, and maybe it's just old school. But I can tell you that that's not trial attorney 101. To show up at trial and not
Mr. Kelly, you know, the thing is, we're a reviewing court, and the problem we have is, of course, not to just routinely allow people to withdraw their guilty plea. So I'm hearing all these things from you, but in my mind, I did not get any objective evidence from you, documentary evidence from you showing that this attorney was not up to par, was not doing his job. And in the way I look at this, I think it's your burden that you should have produced that in terms of what you're presenting to this court. So that's why I'm asking, you know, didn't you have to bring something in your request for a new trial to say, but for this, and why the attorney didn't present it, at least the allegation?
So what I provided and what the record that this court can rely upon reflects is that there was clearly no defense witness list, no defense exhibit list on the day of trial. It was never filed by a trial attorney. And if that is somehow acceptable conduct, that doesn't subject that attorney's performance to scrutiny. I don't know what does. So that is in the record. I rely upon what's not there. I don't know how I produce evidence of something that doesn't exist, other than to show that the record does not, that the record supports my argument as it's
understood
before the court. Thank you.
And your time has expired. All right, Mr. I need to try this. I'm sorry, you went off the screen. There you are. Mr. Hajdukovic, did I pronounce that correctly?
Perfectly, Your Honor.
I wanted to try. You got to try, right?
I always say it's the common spelling, so... Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Nick Hajdukovic. I'm an assistant Washington County attorney, and I represent the respondent, State of Minnesota. The respondent is asking this court to affirm the denial of the appellant's motion to withdraw his guilty plea. And as Your Honors indicated, it was the appellant's burden to demonstrate that counsel was ineffective, both that his representation fell below an objective standard of reasonableness, and that his unreasonably poor representation prejudiced the appellant such that the result would have been different. The appellant failed to meet either of those prongs, much less both. But I want to just begin with a clarification of the facts of the case, because counsel indicates that there is just no indication in the record that there was ever any investigation done or why there wouldn't have been a witness list or an exhibit list filed. And though I don't think those documents needed to be filed for counsel to be effective, document 37 in the document index in the case is a memorandum of law from the state. The prosecutor on the case spoke with previous defense counsel after the after Judge Hannon, without objection from the defense, had executed an order waiving attorney-client privilege. And what counsel stated, previous counsel, is that counsel did in fact look into the information that the appellant wanted him to look into. A witness he wanted to get a statement from avoided speaking to a private investigator that counsel hired. So it's hardly surprising that counsel didn't want to put that name on a witness list, for example. And documents that the appellant gave to his counsel looked at them and concluded that they severely undercut his own case. So obviously,
Mr. Hajdukovic, I'd like to talk to you about that point and your reliance on those discussions with Mr. Madsen's trial counsel. I don't find any affidavit in the record, describing those discussions. All I find, and correct me if I'm wrong, but all I find is the brief by the county attorney. And I don't think that establishes a factual record of the discussions. It's only assertions by counsel. So am I wrong about that? Is there some sort of record support for the assertions you're making here?
What I would say, Your Honor, is there isn't any affidavits or anything like that, and I think it would have been better if there had been. I will.
So absolutely. can we rely on that as fact then? I don't think we can.
Well, what I would say is this: the appellant has never said that that information was wrong, at least not directly. I guess.
Isn't our review limited to the facts in the record?
Yes, and I think. So even if the court doesn't think that it should examine that information, or I guess consider it as a fact that's actually been proven. For one thing, I just wanted to point out that I think there is an explanation, but even putting that aside, as I indicated, it is the appellant's burden, and as the court's questions hinted at, are more than hinted at during
counsel. So in light of that, I'd like you to reframe your argument without relying on that information that's not in the record regarding sure. the discussion with trial counsel.
Sure, Your Honor. As Your Honor indicated during Mr. Kelly's argument, I think what Your Honor believed was the case was that the key points to his argument were the failure to investigate witnesses and to introduce documents. There, as was indicated by the court's questioning, counsel had the burden of demonstrating ineffective assistance, and there were never witness interviews or documents subsequently placed into the record, and they absolutely could have been placed into the record. That's how I've typically seen ineffective assistance of counsel claims litigated, is that there is evidence produced in this type of situation to show that, if counsel hadn't done something or had done something, this would have been the result, because the defense could have presented the testimony of this witness or presented this exhibit that would have demonstrated some important fact in the case. And here, that evidence simply does not exist in the case.
I'm sorry, just following up on that, can you respond to appellant's argument that the testimony about the documents, and it's very brief at the hearing, is sufficient to show that trial counsel was ineffective in failing to provide documents about that show titles to vehicles owned by a car dealership?
Well, I think that's insufficient for a couple of reasons. One, as you indicated, it's very short, and there's no explanation really of why that's relevant in the testimony. There's argument about its relevance, I suppose, but the testimony doesn't establish that it's why it's so important. But even putting that aside, I think the judge was frankly entitled to disregard that, because all of this is contrary to appellant's sworn testimony at his plea hearing, where he said he'd had enough time to consult with counsel, where he believed counsel was fully informed about the facts of his case. The plea petition, again, where he acknowledged all of his trial rights, including the right to call witnesses favorable to him if he proceeded to trial. He knew all of those things. He acknowledged all of those things under oath at his plea hearing, and then made statements that are really inconsistent with that later on. So Judge Hannon wasn't required to take that information as true, and she didn't make any explicit credibility determination. So I don't want to be heard as saying that she did. But what she concluded was really that this was just that the appellant regretted his decision, but that wasn't sufficient to meet the standard. She looked at her notes of the plea, because at the time the plea transcript hadn't been ordered, so all she had were her notes from the plea, but she noted there was nothing unusual about the plea in terms of the appellant's presentation, nothing to indicate that it was involuntary or that she observed any particular concerns during the plea. And again, as was discussed during counsel's argument, she also noted that in her experience, exhibit and witness lists are rarely filed by the defense, and that doesn't preclude the defense from presenting exhibits or witnesses. And that's been my experience as well, that judges typically won't preclude that information as long as there's not extraordinary circumstances where it appears counsel was just essentially attempting to hide the ball, but that's rarely the case. So I think that is consistent with experience as well as, her own statements. So given all that, there's a failure to demonstrate either that there is any sort of ineffective assistance in terms of falling below an objective standard of reasonableness. And regardless of that, the court doesn't even need to examine that prong if it doesn't want to, because the appellant simply has failed to demonstrate any prejudice by any substantive representation.
Mr. Hadukovich, I have a question on that issue. Would not the appellant's testimony at the hearing be sufficient for the second prong? Because his point being that, but for the failure to present that evidence and to the to present, and which is why he believed his attorney wasn't prepared, I would not have pled guilty. Wouldn't that be sufficient to satisfy the prejudice prong?
Well, I guess it depends on what the prejudice prong would require. If it's if the different result is that he wouldn't have pleaded guilty and would have proceeded to trial, then perhaps it does. And I guess that's not something I'd previously considered. I was considering it, and the outcome would have been different in terms of he could have proceeded to trial, and there's a reasonable likelihood of him being acquitted, because ultimately the outcome here is obviously he's convicted, whether he pleaded guilty or if he had been convicted of at trial. Versus, in my mind, I guess the opposite of that would be being acquitted at trial. That's a fair point, and I guess I hadn't considered prejudice prong in that way. But regardless of that, I think that there is. But again, Judge Hannon, I think, was still able to disregard that if she so chose, because again of the contradictions or the inconsistencies between what appellant said during his plea under oath and then what he said later during the hearing after he regretted his decision to plead guilty. So the fact that he said it doesn't necessarily get him there, I would say, because Judge Hannon still has discretion on how to interpret that. And obviously judges have broad discretion in this type of scenario where there's an attempt to withdraw a guilty plea.
And maybe I'll just direct you back to the first prong, Mr. Hajdukovic. I'll just say as a broad, I can at least intuitively appreciate the importance of the fact that he's a car salesman and has title to 50 cars. My question to you is, what evidence do you believe the appellant failed to submit as it relates to that and this particular car they did plead guilty to that you think would have got over the hump of at least that first Strickland prong?
Well, I think it's either the documents themselves that are being referred to, but they're never... we've never actually seen them. We just have a claim that they exist. And secondly, any witness statements, again, that are being referenced repeatedly, but we've never actually heard what any of those witnesses would have to say. And so without those things, we're left to just guess. And again, it's the appellant's burden on both of those prongs. And so our position is that the appellant has failed to meet that burden on either prong, much less both of them. If there are no further questions.
I have one further question. Just going back to the discussion we had earlier about the brief that was filed in district court, kind of summarizing discussions that were had with trial counsel. Can you point to any case law that you would contend that would support this court relying on discussions that are described in a brief without actual evidentiary support for those discussions, such as an affidavit or some other type of record support?
I cannot point to any specific cases on that particular issue, no, Your Honor.
Thank you. And with regard to the titles, then, what's your view there, as I understand it, is that the district court didn't necessarily accept that testimony as true, that there was documentation to support that?
Correct, or at least that the documentation mattered, because I'm basing that on what Judge Hannon said in her ruling, pages 20 to 21 of that transcript, where what she ultimately concludes is that the appellant may have regretted his decision to plead guilty, but didn't meet the standard of fair and just. And so what I am inferring, I think what can be reasonably inferred from that is she concluded that he hadn't met the burden of showing ineffective assistance of counsel. And I think her second finding is even more significant, or the later statement about exhibit and witness lists rarely being filed, but not precluding them from presenting evidence, as I think certainly precluding that aspect of the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, that she would have allowed that evidence to be presented. And frankly, nobody asked. It wasn't a situation where somebody was told, well, you didn't file an exhibit list or a witness list, so you don't get to present this evidence. Nobody asked because he pleaded guilty. And he was satisfied at that time with counsel's representation. And so I think Judge Hannon was well within her discretion to conclude that his testimony at the plea hearing did not establish ineffective assistance.
And he would have had to have shown that the failure to include those documents on an exhibit list was not a strategic decision, but trial decision, but was basically inadequate representation, correct?
Correct, Your Honor. Yes, that's right. And I there was no evidence presented to demonstrate that that fell below an objective standard of reasonableness, nor is there case law that, you know, would previously have recognized, that I'm aware of at least, such conduct to meet that standard.
Anything else?
If there's no further questions, I will waive the remainder of my time and ask this court to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Kelly, we're back to you. You have the last word.
Thank you. So first, I want to address what I believe is a misframing of my burden before this court by the argument of the respondent, as well as some of the comments from the court. I think it's a straw man argument to say that I have to establish ineffective assistance of counsel and that there was a reasonable standard of care that was not met and that it would have been a different result. That is the burden under 1505 sub 1 when you're trying to argue manifest injustice. To establish manifest injustice, I would have to establish ineffective assistance of counsel. Under the Townsend case and under the rule that we're proceeding forward under, subdivision 2, I simply have a burden of advancing reasons to support my motion to withdraw the guilty plea. Far less than ineffective assistance of counsel. In other words, under Townsend, the defendant is not permitted to withdraw a guilty plea for simply any reason. Well, I have way more than simply any reason in this record. Now, we have first and foremost the sworn testimony of my client, uncontroverted, before the district court. And I would respectfully suggest that this court does review pages 20 and 21 of the transcript from that motion to withdraw and the findings of the district court. There was no written order. It was by Zoom. It was a Zoom hearing. At no point in time does she say that my client's testimony lacked credibility. At no point in time does she say, well, you say these documents exist, but I'm not sure they do. They're Department of Motor Vehicle documents. This is sworn testimony. My affidavit identifies them, supporting my motion to withdraw as well. Nobody contradicts that. Nobody ever argues that that's not credible. The court simply finds that based upon the fact that there was this waiver of rights, acknowledgement.
Mr. Kelly, without submission of the documents, how can the court have abused its discretion in concluding that there wasn't a demonstration of a fair and just reason to withdraw, given that it's without the documents, it's not entirely clear how what they said and how, whether they in fact would have supported a strong defense for your client. I mean, without the documents, how can we know that it wasn't a strategic decision by the attorney that they didn't really support your client's position?
I would submit that
the description of the documents in the transcript is extremely general. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So I would indicate to this court that it's a reference to a government record. Okay, so the Department of Motor Vehicles has this list. My client has a license to buy and sell cars. This is part of the record. This is part of the record when he talks to the police. This is in the police report and in
the police report isn't in the record, Mr. Kelly.
I understand that. What I'm saying is that the district court parties are aware that this is was my client's explanation from day one. Nobody at any point in time discredits the testimony of my client. The court simply concludes that the fact that there was no witness list and no exhibit list does not amount to a reason to withdraw the guilty plea. The 11th hour change of the plea to a no jail deal and the pressure that my client was under being told by his ill-prepared trial counsel that he should accept this deal, that's simply not enough under the lower standard. And I simply would once again point to the what's not in the record. There's no possible, I can't imagine any possible reason why when the your client is arrested for receiving stolen property and he's a used car dealer, that his records are not somehow helpful to his defense.
Well, Mr. Kelly, given that this is a motion to withdraw a guilty plea, why not submit the records with along with the motion to support the case?
Mr. Kelly, your time expired, but please answer Judge Cochran's question.
So as it was uncontroverted, my client's testimony was deemed sufficient.
Judges, anything else? It appears not. Thank you then to the attorneys for appearing on the Zoom platform. We also hope we're going to be having Zoom in our rearview mirror. With that said, thank you for your arguments today. They